The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Hey folks, before the podcast starts, I want to tell you about an event. You can celebrate the end of the work week at the Museum of Science and Industry, Chicago. Tickets are on sale now for MSI After Hours, the Second City Comedy Lab. On Friday, September 8th, from 7 to 10 at night, enjoy a cocktail and get exclusive access to more than a dozen of MSI's hands-on exhibits. Plus, hang out with the actors from the Second City during comedy workshops and watch cast members and MSI insiders come up with one-of-a-kind improv show about science, robotics, and little-known artifacts. Visit msichicago.org/afterhours to buy your tickets. Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guests today on Getting to Yes And are Karen Stobey and Mondi Carter. Their story was brilliantly told on an episode of This American Life called Magic Words. They are both actors and improvisers whose lives were changed when both of Karen's parents were diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Karen and Mondi have turned both of their worlds into their life's work. They have presented over 700 workshops, keynotes, and performances on this topic, including a presentation at the International TED Med Conference. Their six-week training program called In the Moment can be found at www.in-themoment.net. Karen and Mondi, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot.
It's nice to be here.
So back in 2012, I had my first experience in dealing with a family member in decline. My mom had had a series of health struggles, and she developed dementia. And it was like so heartbreaking and frustrating and unnerving to be in these conversations with her when she would go off into another reality. And although I've worked in improvisation my entire adult life, I wrote a book called Yes And, I never thought of applying that particular skill set to this particular situation. So I didn't yes and my mom, but like you guys did. What happened?
So it didn't come, I think like you, it didn't come right away. Right. I think when it happens to you personally, it's not the clearest avenue, even though like you, it's been part of my whole adult life. Mm-hmm. What happened with me was my dad was finally diagnosed, and a lot of family members, you look back and you realize, oh boy, this has been happening for a while. And when he was finally diagnosed, I started going to workshops and presentations and conferences and thought, I just want to know all I can about what is Alzheimer's disease. And I distinctly remember sitting in a workshop and thinking, I am so bored out of my mind. If they would just play this improv exercise instead of reading that PowerPoint, it would be so much better. And then I just started writing down all these different improv exercises and games and ideas of how you could use them as a teaching tool instead of PowerPoint or lecture. And the next thing I know, I was going all over the internet looking for the quote unquote guidelines of caregiving for someone with Alzheimer's and then the guidelines for improv, because really there are no, we can say there's rules, but there's not.
Right, right.
Because once we make the rules, you know, we break them, mm-hmm. you know. And so I found these guidelines for both. And I went and I showed this friend of mine who was the director of an adult day center the rules for improv. And she looked at it and she looked at me and she said, What are you doing, some kind of Alzheimer's workshop? Huh. And then I took the rules for caregiving for someone with Alzheimer's and showed my husband, who was just the same way. Mundy was like, what is this about? Are you doing some improv workshop? And so that was like a little, you know, light bulb that went, this makes so much sense. But to be quite honest, the person that really grab the reins of using the guidelines for improv and using them with my mom was Mundy, because it was still just not in my forefront. As a daughter that I was carrying around on my back, that it was just super clear to him and just easier, because he wasn't dealing with any of the emotional or mental part of the baggage. He was just hanging out with mom.
Yeah,
I think it's when it's your own mom or dad, you want them to be the person they've been, and you try and keep on giving them opportunities to do that, and they keep on not taking those opportunities, and that's when the sort of connection to a real emotional denial comes along. That's where you really start saying, you know, no in a really deep way to what's going on, where I didn't have that kind of connection. So Karen said, just sort of approach her as you would a open improv scene, and I was good.
Right. And what's interesting about this, too, and I know we're, you know this, people always confuse improvisation for comedy. And what I often sort of say is, you know, improvisation really gets at our most human self, and that is so often funny. But there are lessons from comedy, and one of those things is distance, right? And so, Karen, I mean, like, you did not have the emotional distance probably to be able to jump into that in the same way that Mondi could. And so it's different for different people, and that's okay. I think that's – and this is, I think, what improvisation teaches us, is that we have to be agile in the moment to adapt to a mutual reality that is ever-shifting and ever-changing, which is not our natural state.
Right. I mean, totally not. And I think for family caregivers, that is the biggest hurdle, is to get over that need for that distance and to figure out what you can and can't do. But I think because my mom lived with us full time for 10 years, and she just recently moved into an assisted living here in town, is that it took me probably half of those years, about 5 years, to figure out this is not about her, this problem I'm having. Mm-hmm. It's about me. Mm-hmm. It's about the fact that my identity is being challenged. And once I realized that I am still who I am no matter what, and she is who she is, I was able to connect much more and to use these principles much more. And one of the biggest ones that I tell family members is the go with the flow.
Yeah.
The just go with what's happening, like we do on stage in improv. And it's the same thing. If you can just let everything else go and go with wherever the person wants to go, it can totally change your relationship.
It's funny. I was telling someone a story related to this, and it was, we were just in Aspen at the Spotlight Health section talking about a program that we've developed at Second City with Caring Across Generations for caregivers. And I sort of related a story that I know from Second City. So I oversaw hiring talent at Second City for over 2 decades. So I would be the guy at these auditions where we'd see thousands of people. And what would happen, especially in the early days, is every once in a while someone would have been signed up and they had no business being there. They maybe never took an improv class. you've probably seen these people who they just think they're funny and someone wasn't listening or checking. And what we often do is when we realize we have someone who's auditioning who is just not skilled or perhaps a bit off in a way, we match them with the best improviser in that room. Because they will say yes and not block, go with the flow in a way that will make the experience at least, you know, tolerable and sometimes incredibly hilarious. Because that's the sort of unique skill set, right? I'm curious for you guys, like, and I know this now because of all the research I've done in our program that we have with the University of Chicago, there's science to back all of this stuff up. And that was amazing to me. The more I read, the more I sort of investigated thinkers of neuroscience and behavioral science, there's a lot of stuff out there that backs up that this is the best way to approach a lot of different difficult conversations and difficult relationships.
Actually, yes. And the interesting thing is that when you relate that to family members and have them understand, or to those who are providing care in any care community, they start to understand and see the person that's living with Alzheimer's as just like them. Mm-hmm. And really, in order to create relationships, you know, you need to have that relationship on stage in order to do improv. Mm-hmm. And in order to create this relationship with a person with Alzheimer's, it is about seeing them as you are. And just as you just said, you know, how many times if someone is living in a nursing home, do we walk in, open the drapes, wake them up and tell them it's time to get up? And then when they reach out to hit you because they don't recognize who you are, which is very, very normal. If someone walked into my bedroom or your bedroom mm-hmm. and you didn't recognize them and they didn't tell you who they were, you would do the exact same thing.
Right.
And I really believe that most of their life, they're just trying to go with the flow and fill in the blanks of the information that they're given. And when you think about when you hit the stage, that's basically what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You got this information that you've got, the audience gave you. You know that you're seen as about a policeman and a stripper, and you've got to fit in orange somewhere. And that's the information you got, and you've got to make that work.
Yeah.
And it's the same. I just feel like that if we can see the people that are living with dementia more like we are and realize that they're just trying to get through their day just like we are, the more that we can have this common relationship too.
I just interviewed Kelly McGonigal, who wrote Stanford psychologist, wrote a book called The Upside of Stress. And so much in this book relates to the things that you're talking about. And she has a quote in the book that, quote, seeing the upside of adversity changes the way people cope. And it's this whole idea around post-traumatic growth, the idea that, you know, resilient behaviors can allow people to actually, you know, live very meaningfully, if not more meaningfully, when they're touched by various kinds of tragedies. And there's you know, they've gotten some people upset about this because they're like, well, are you saying that, like, tragedies are good? And it's like, well, no, but they're inevitable. You know, we are all going to die. You know, we're going to have a parent who dies.
Right.
You know, we're all going to do that. So it's a reality. And then how are we choosing? What's our mindset to approach this? And the interesting thing about improvisation is that when you study mindfulness, it's very related. The key difference being when you're improvising, you're doing what I like to call loud, noisy group mindfulness. It's more of like mindfulness engaged in the world as it is, rather than sort of like in a meditative by yourself kind of way. And so I've you start to see that going forward. Like, this is really useful in this situation, and probably, by the way, many situations, because a lot of conversations are difficult when you're dealing with, you know, coworkers or between generations or between races or ethnicities. I mean, my God, look what's going on in the world right now.
Yeah. I mean, people get very connected to their own thoughts and ideas, and that sort of a bad place when you get into improv of being inside your own head. Mm-hmm. People who have been sort of overtly dependent upon their own rationality find themselves really inside their own head when they're trying to take care of somebody with Alzheimer's, because they're confronted with this person who will not give up on what the caregiver sees as irrational behavior. But if you follow the fundamentals of improv, you can get yourself out of your head, both, you know, for an improv scene and also in this sort of caregiving situation where you just want to connect with that other person. And it just allows you to be able to sort of reach out and get that connection. When you don't feel like you are at odds with the person you're caring for, then you can breathe, you can move forward, and you develop that patience that can serve you in any situation forward. So, I mean, taking care of Karen's mom for so long has enabled me to be a whole lot more patient with my own parents, who certainly don't have any diagnosed disorders.
Yeah.
but
they're human beings. But, they're your parents, and they're human beings. We all know.
Human beings, and they are my parents.
Yeah.
And so, you know,
just as anyone with their own parents has a kind of button that they get pushed, I have learned to be able to not have those buttons be pushed and see the motivations of my parents for what they are. Because like whenever you're getting frustrated in a caregiving situation, you start to see your own feelings more than anything else.
Right.
You get blinded by your own frustrations, like, why won't they do this? Or why are they hurting my feelings? But if you are following those fundamentals to improv, you're able to accept any of those things come along, and you have a broader perspective so that you do that reflexive yes and, mm-hmm. and you move forward than you would if you would just had that, if you didn't have that training and you have that sort of reflexive no that goes along.
Yeah. And even thinking about that yes and is such a simple idea. But when you present that to people who work in this situation every single day, and the one thing is that part of the work that I do is going out and talking to those direct caregivers, people that are helping to care for 8, 10, 12, 16 different people that are individuals, and because it's a brain disease, it's affecting them individually. Mm-hmm. And just that simple idea of yes-anding is such a light bulb moment for them and so beneficial, because when you think about how often the older you are and any time that you develop more and more different abilities and life-changing conditions and then diseases, that you are hearing no's. Mm-hmm. And whether they're physical, mental, emotional, it feels like you're just getting these no's piled on to you. And when you bring that up and say, somebody says to you that they want to go home, and you look at that as, well, let's think about the why of this person wanting to go home. What's mm-hmm. behind that? But also yes and it.
Yep.
To explore that, yes, I hear you, and tell me about that home. And yes, I bet it is a beautiful place. Let's mm-hmm. paint a picture of it. Or yes, and it changes their perspective, and it also creates this communication between two people by just yes-anding a situation. And it also gets people thinking about, well, the why behind this. And this poor word, you know, behavior in the world of dementia has just gotten this really bad rap that, you know, even you, if you think about the word behavior – when you think about dementia, I bet your mind goes to what words?
Oh, I mean, I go to negative. I immediately think that they're going to
have
a misbehavior.
Right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. We all do. I mean, every single person across the United States, and in healthcare or not in healthcare, we go to the negative. Mm-hmm. And so when we do that, we have this mindset then that they're going to have bad behavior and it has to be managed and it's inappropriate, when actually it's quite normal for their situation. And so in my work now, I don't even use the word. I say actions and reactions.
Right.
Because most of the time, they're just reacting to our poor actions. Sometimes that's hard for us to hear, but it's pretty true.
Yeah. And you bring up a really good point in there as well, which is, for us, because we've been at this so long in this field, and yes and's like the first thing you always, you know, learn, and you kind of get it, and you never, you know, no like experienced improviser actually even uses the words yes and on stage. It is a mindset and
right.
a position. You know, you forget how radical of a concept that is when introduced to people who are not involved with this work, because they've lived in the abounding culture is no. Or yes, but at best, it is not yes.
Exactly.
So this is.
How many?
Go ahead.
How many women's magazines articles out there saying you don't say no enough? You know, learn to say no, and instead of this yes and is such a better premise than saying no. But I hear you, and I think it is so true that I don't remember the last time I said it on stage, but you learn it, and then that's when you can let go of it.
Right.
So, and with these CNAs and nurses and family caregivers, to just get this one concept, it's pretty miraculous when they do. They have this aha. I get emails from folks that say, wow, I get this. And people ask me, like, what's some of the biggest lessons in this connection between? And to be honest, it is that yes and the go with the flow and to accept the world, the reality that's given to you. And then really it's to listen. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that we cannot stress and teach that enough, that it is so hard to slow down in this world right now and to just purely listen to someone.
Yeah, and listen for intent, listen deeply. All the things that we learn, because there's so many different kinds of cues you're picking up. I'm actually going to allow us to get a little bit deeper in the improv weeds. Are you Spolin trained or Johnstone trained? What's your background in terms of how you came to improv?
Actually, my background came about in an odd way, in the sense that I was studying to be a sign language interpreter.
Uh-huh.
And so I was very interested in what the body says, because when you are interpreting for ASL, you are using your face, you know, as much as your hands.
Mm-hmm.
And so I studied actually improv with a group of deaf improvisers.
Wow.
In the very beginning. And then I was studying with theater sports and
yep.
comedy sports. And then I started to study through some other teachers that were in Milwaukee and Chicago too.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
And
Mundy?
I basically just doing comedy sports and reading, Viola Spolin and Keith Johnstone and Augusto Boal.
Yep.
And and doing some workshops in that area, and just doing a lot of two-person shows and remotes, and then just doing a lot of shows.
Mm-hmm. So what's interesting about this to me is so Second City arises out of the Spolin tradition, but theater sports and comedy sports and basically all of the West Coast comes mostly out of Johnstone, Keith Johnstone, who is a British born theater practitioner who then moved to Canada. And the interesting thing that the key differentiation between the two is Spolin is very behavior-based and Johnstone is very story-based. And so one of the things that I kind of found interesting in what you guys are doing that touches both, right? So Spolin has this behavior stuff that we're all talking about, the sort of yes and, you know, the that sort of rules. But Johnstone, builds narratives and story out of this. And there's an idea in science that's called restorative narratives. Basically, this idea that mm-hmm. as part of a caregiving situation or a healing process, the fact that we can sort of own our stories and then share our stories has been proven over and over again to have transformational impact. And that's, I know, a slightly sort of deeper thing, but it feels to me like you guys do so much storytelling in your work, and it seems to me that every time you share that story and get other people to share their stories, you're taking this a step further in your own sort of happiness and contentment and mindfulness moving forward in the world.
I have to say that what you just said just made me chuckle, because I feel like it's my own therapy session so many times.
Right, right.
That when I'm out there and I'm sharing a story about myself, some people will say to me, how do you talk about these stories about your father or your mother, about what you've done? And I'm like, well, it's healing. And it's improvising. The story is never the same, of course.
Yeah.
But I feel that, you know, stories, of course, are so amazing and important, but every single time that I talk about this or talk about how I want families to understand that this is not easy,
mm-hmm.
that this is hard. But once they get the hang of this approach, that it will make their life easier. And I think that both Mundy and I have veered off of both of those paths in a lot of ways. And once you start veering off and doing, you know, very odd. It's a very odd improv you do when you're performing for healthcare people that have never heard or understand improv in any way, and that we do it, and that they can see it in the act of us playing.
Yeah.
That how do you do this? But then doing it again, almost doing like a replay scenario where you can show then, okay, you see it in play, how fun it can be. But now let's see it if we apply it to the situation. That it's such a lovely way to learn through thing and learn through so that they can go back and do immediately. That I think it's also this joyous process in learning, not through any other technique, but through improv, and then having them do it themselves. Mm-hmm. One of the most popular exercises, one of the most simplest exercises that I usually do in every single talk is the game of pair mirrors. Is one of the most simple, as you know, I mean, everybody has done a mirror game if you've taken a theater improv class.
Yep.
But the way that I do it is that I time it, and then I also have them pair up with someone they do not know. And so they have this experience of just looking in somebody's eyes for 90 seconds and seeing what that feels like. And then I just listen to them tell me what they got from it. And from doing this with 20 people to 1,300 people, it is an amazing journey to hear every time what they've learned from that. And it's always, it comes down to this 90-second that is created by being with this other person. And you can hear these little moments and gasps of them saying, you know, I don't give that, even that 90 seconds to the person I'm caring for. That it's hard to be with them in that way, silent, and looking in their eyes and experiencing it face to face. So that's what I love about improv exercises, and what people can take away is their own individual unique experience. And I think that's what people get from watching good improv, and that it's their own experience. People will laugh at different things and experience it in their own way. But I think it's a very valuable, and I love that I'm seeing it more and more. I mean, this has been 20 years of me. When I first started out doing this, I couldn't say you're about to do an improv exercise.
Right.
I would just say, okay, everybody stand up, and this is what we're going to do, because they would run out of the room. They're frightened of it.
Yeah.
And now people love it, and they understand it, and they're getting it more and more. But I think it's so great that it's happening more and more out there.
I think there's a bigger reaction too now than there used to be, because, well, at least for the last 5 or 6 years, people spend so much more time looking at their phones than they do at other people, that when they have this 90-second experience of just experiencing listening to another person with their whole self, you know, that's essentially what mirrors is this sort of like listening with every part of your body in reflecting it, that they, that it's even more powerful now that because people are even more divorced from each other than they used to be.
Right. I was saying this at Second City today. We were in a conversation, and I said, if you think we're needed now, which we are, and this work is needed now, fast forward 15 or 20 years when the only jobs that are going to be available to people are ones that are distinctly human, because everything else is going to be automated.
Right. That's right. Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Like that is coming. Every futurist has said it. Even the art of surgery is probably going to be done in some sort of automated fashion. And so, you know, when you think about the skills that are going to be needed in the future, the kinds of jobs, it's going to be people tapping into deep work, deep craft, and things that are essentially human. So, you know, it's fascinating, because we collectively have been at this for a long time. And you're right, 5, 6, 7 years ago, you know, you're still having to convince people of the worthiness of this work. And that's changed. They're, you know, from what we're doing at Second City in academia to the kinds of corporate clients that we're working with, you know, there now seems to be a real understanding of, yep, this is a value. And I think you guys are doing God's work, and I'm very excited to see where this goes next, because it's the need is just going to be greater down the line.
It really is. And I think it's one of those things that if we could get this kind of curriculum into schools as early as possible, so that people would have this kind of active imagination encouraged throughout their life, it would really be helpful for us across the board. Being able to have patience with people, being able to accept different points of view, being able to hold different points of view in your mind and not have to come to a conclusion about them. These things are really very valuable and becoming rarer.
Well, I think that'd be great to get an elementary and all, but I just want to try and get it into medical schools.
Yep.
Because if we can reach every single medical school, because it's still what's being taught out there is everything's got to be precise and measured and it's got to be charted. And it's true. Yes, we want that. I want my right dosage of medicine. But at the same time, we're not teaching them to be humans and to take time and to be patient. And when we're, that should be with any patient. But in this world of dementia, it is so unique. And every single person is different from the other. And so it even is bigger. And so the more people that know about this, the more people that are teaching it, that's it. That's what we need. We need it out there.
Karen Stobey and Mondi Carter, you can find them at www.in-themoment.net. Thanks, you guys, for being on the show.
Thanks, Kelly. We appreciate it.
Well, I've been working in a home.